We actually began that story 2 weeks ago with verse 6. Hosea prophesies at that time that the calf of Samaria, that would be the golden calves, actually Jeroboam the first set up two, one in the far north, Dan, and one in the south, Bethel, obviously concerned about his people returning to Jerusalem, and his kingdom would ultimately fall apart as a result. Jeroboam is the one who set them up, and we see him actually leading in sacrifice, particularly at the one in the south, Bethel. But Hosea, and this is 100 years now with Hosea prophesying that the calf of Samaria would be broken to pieces, and that's probably a couple of hundred years after Jeroboam set them up. The time span is interesting to me, but many more things are interesting and I think useful as well. Josiah's dates, I'll note again, somewhere in the range of 628 to 609, and looking back to the first Jeroboam, his dates would be in the 900s, 922 to I think all of these dates are somewhat approximate, but that gives us an idea of the time involved. And we talked about the story of Josiah, a very interesting story, a boy king. But when the book of the law was found, apparently dusty and dirty in the back of the temple, then Josiah took up his reforms. An amazing story again in and of itself. Okay, we looked at some of the many things that Josiah did in his reforms. I think one could almost use the word restoration as well. We need to remind ourselves that he didn't just do this in the southern kingdom, Judah, but he went to Israel as well. And while the detail is not there for us, nevertheless, he did this all over what used to be Israel. And we remind ourselves that 100 years before, Israel had been taken into captivity. So now it's a land populated by mixed peoples. It's a foreign country in a sense, but nevertheless, Josiah went north and performed his reforms as well. God's hand must have certainly been with Josiah. I don't understand how he could have done it without a lot of pushback, but he accomplished that as well. That's passed over quickly. But picking up here, as he was destroying the altar in Bethel, he looked up on the mountain and he said, "What is that monument that I see?" And the men told him, "It's the tomb of the man of God who came from Judah and predicted these things that you have done against the altar at Bethel." The man of God is that prophet that goes nameless, will go nameless always. simply referred to as the man of God. Okay, in that section that we have already looked at, he wouldn't burn the bones in a particular grave. He did most of them, but and that, of course, was to defile the altar there at the image in Bethel. Okay, whose bones are those, and what is that story? So we go back to 1 Kings 13 to get the first part of the story. This is going backwards, but in a sense, I think it is almost helpful to do it that way. Josiah and what he did, and then to look back at how Josiah would have known about bones and what not to do with them. Okay, I think maybe it may be tedious to read it to you, but that may be the best way. And behold, a man of God came out of Judah by the word of the Lord to Bethel. Jeroboam was standing by the altar. This is at the time of Jeroboam the first, to make offerings. And the man cried against the altar by the word of the Lord and said, O altar, altar, thus says the Lord, behold, a son shall be born to the house of David, Josiah by name. Okay, you probably already know this, but remember that it's not just someone in the future. The name Josiah is given some 300 years before. Josiah by name, and he will sacrifice on you the priests of the high places. And we've read about that. Josiah did that. And make offerings on you, and human bones shall be burned on you. And he gave a sign the same day, saying, this is the sign that the Lord has spoken. Behold, the altar shall be torn down, and the ashes that are on it shall be poured out. And when the king is there, Jeroboam, and when the king heard the saying of the man of God, which he cried against the altar at Bethel, Jeroboam stretched out his hand from the altar, saying, seize him. And his hand, which he stretched out against him, dried up so that he could not draw it back to himself. In a moment, we'll read that you would think this would be a major change in the life of Jeroboam the first, but the end of the story is that he continued along the same paths that he was already following at this time. And the altar was torn down, the ashes poured out from the altar according to the sign that the man of God had given by the word of the Lord. And the king said to the man of God, entreat now the favor of the Lord your God and pray for me that my hand may be restored to me. And the man of God entreated the Lord, and the king's hand was restored to him and became as it was before. And the king said to the man of God, come home with me and refresh yourself, and I will give you a reward. And the man of God said, if you give me half your house, I will not go in with you, and I will not eat bread or drink water in this place, for it was commanded me by the word of the Lord, saying, you shall neither eat bread nor drink water, nor return by the way that you came. So he went another away and did not return by the way he came to Bethel. Now an old prophet lived in Bethel, and his sons came and told him all that the man of God had done that day in Bethel. They also told their father the words that he had spoken to the king. And the father said to them, which way did he go? And his sons showed him the way that the man of God who came from Judah had gone. And he said to his son, saddle the donkey for me. So they saddled the donkey for him, and he mounted it, and he went after the man of God and found him sitting under an oak. And he said to him, are you the man of God who came from Judah? And he said, I am. Then he said to him, come home with me and eat bread. There's repetition, but the repetition obviously is here for a purpose to him, to impress us. And he said, I may not return with you or go in with you, neither will I eat bread nor drink water with you in this place. For it was said to me by the word of the Lord, you shall neither eat bread nor drink water there, nor return by the way that you came. And he said to him, I also am a prophet as you are. And an angel spoke to me by the word of the Lord, saying, bring him back with you into your house, that he may eat bread and drink water. But he lied to him. So he went back with him and ate bread in his house and drank water. And the men of God said to the king, and as they sat at the table, the word of the Lord came to the prophet who had brought him back. And he cried to the man of God who came from Judah, thus says the Lord, because you have disobeyed the word of the Lord and have not kept the command that the Lord your God commanded you, but have come back and have eaten bread and drunk water in the place of which he said to you, eat no bread and drink no water, your body shall not come to the tomb of your fathers. And after he'd eaten bread and drunk, he saddled the donkey for the prophet whom he had brought back. And as he went away, a lion met him on the road and killed him. And his body was thrown in the road, and the donkey stood beside it. The lion also stood beside the body. And behold, men passed by and saw the body thrown in the road and the lion standing by the body. And they came and told it in the city where the old prophet lived. And when the prophet who had brought him back from the way heard of it, he said, it's the man of God who disobeyed the word of the Lord. Therefore the Lord has given him to the lion, which has torn him and killed him, according to the word that the Lord spoke to him. And he said to his sons, saddle the donkey for me. And they saddled it, and he went and found his body thrown in the road, and the donkey and the lion standing beside the body. The lion had not eaten the body or torn the donkey. And the prophet took up the body of the man of God and laid it on the donkey and brought him back to the city to mourn and bury him. And they laid the body in the old prophet's grave. And they mourned over him, saying, alas, my brother. And after he had buried him, he said to his sons, when I die, bury me in the grave in which the man of God is buried. Lay my bones beside his bones. For the saying that he called out by the word of the Lord against the altar in Bethel and against all the houses of the high places that are in the cities of Samaria shall surely come to pass. Okay, so 100 years after Hosea has prophesied the destruction of that altar, which is in our starting place in chapter 8, and some 300 years after Jeroboam the first king of the northern kingdom, Israel, Josiah burned the bones out of the high places, many of them very likely graves of priests of Baal. And the purpose, of course, not only to destroy the altar, but to defile it with dead men's bones. Okay, I take note that the old prophet said, put my bones in the same grave with him. Okay, just to reemphasize, we're told, though, in 1 Kings 13, but Jeroboam didn't turn from his evil way. Think about that. It would be one thing to see with your own eyes a miracle performed. With Jeroboam's situation, he was the object of a miracle himself. He felt it all. He saw it all. One would think if a man is ever going to turn his life around, this would be the occasion that he would do it. But in spite of that, he went on with all of his practices, appointing, by the way, this is important as well. One of the changes that Jeroboam made from the law of Moses was to make anyone a priest. And you'll notice wording, he ordained priests from among all the people, any who would. And I can imagine that he ordained some as priests as favors to them and expecting favors later from others. But quite different, of course, from finding priests only from the tribe of Levi. And we're told emphatically that became a sin to the house of Jeroboam so as to cut it off and to destroy it from the face of the earth. All of that back in 1 Kings 13. Well, back to Hosea, that was verse 6 before. In verse 7 he says, "For they sow the wind and they shall reap the whirlwind." Sowing and reaping is an image, of course, that we're familiar with, and the Apostle Paul used it in Galatians. Hosea uses it twice here and again in chapter 10. In their idolatry and their political alliances, and we've already talked about Israel looking for help in Egypt, looking for help in Syria, and I have to make sure that I don't mix up in my mind Syria and Assyria. The great power is Assyria, actually a great distance away from Israel. The nearer neighbors would be Syria and Egypt, and Israel went there looking for help, making alliances, hoping to save themselves ultimately from the great power of Assyria. But I think we can sum up Hosea by saying he says that Israel was trying to sow seeds that would produce a good harvest, but they were simply sowing to the wind, vanity, nothing. And in the end would reap the tornado. Nothing would stop the Assyrian army. The harvest would be far more powerful than the seed. And a little later, hopefully we can talk a bit about the Assyrian nation, their power, their practices when they captured this kingdom and that kingdom. And it is a daunting story to be told. But he goes on to say the sowing and the reaping would even be demonstrated in their crops. The crops would not be good. And even a blighted crop where you got some harvest, even that would be taken by foreigners. So everything would be gone. Israel is swallowed up. Already they are among the nations as a useless vessel. This too, I think, looks to the fact that they were looking for alliances, for help, in order to hopefully save themselves from the greater power later. But Hosea says it's already lost. Israel is already swallowed up. The nations around look at Israel as a worthless, useless vessel. For they've gone up to Assyria, a wild donkey, wandering alone. Israel has hired lovers. Again, of reference to the alliances that they had sought to make, looking to a time when indeed they would have to save themselves from Assyria. The message is, though God has forsaken her, and her allies have also forsaken her. But Israel has hired her lovers. She has sold herself away for money, but in the end, it's all vain. Though they hire allies among the nations, I will soon gather them up, and the kings and princes will soon writhe because of the tribute. Of course, when the conquerors came, poor would suffer. Maybe they would suffer the most, but this verse thinks in terms of kings and princes. If they were spared, they would lose a great deal of their possessions trying to buy themselves freedom. A note here about Egypt, because Hosea will refer to Egypt 13 times. When we talk about, and I do plan later on to talk about what the captivity was like, and what happened to the land after the captivity, and so forth. And in looking at that, I think there is some evidence that those who tried to escape from Israel, some of them may have made it safely to Egypt, and made their lives in Egypt. But I think it's still true that, particularly in this section, we remember that Egypt may not be literally Egypt. I think Egypt, much of the time, will stand for captivity, and the actual captivity will be in Assyria. Three ways he uses Egypt. Sometimes in looking back, obviously the Exodus, and that makes perfect sense. And in the present, in Hosea's present, he can refer to the attempted alliances with Egypt, but also in the future. And I think most of the time, at least when he refers to Egypt, it's in a symbolic sense. Three times in this section, 8:11 to 9:9, he says they will return to Egypt. But when we come to chapter 11 and verse 5, we'll see that he says they shall not return to the land of Egypt, but Assyria shall be their king. And that may be our key, that he uses the term Egypt a lot, but many times in a symbolic way. Because Ephraim has multiplied altars for sinning, they have become to him altars for sinning. The Lord, of course, had decreed one place of worship, one altar, but obviously during Hosea's time and in other times as well, many places of worship have been created, and we do run into the phrase every now and then, under every green tree. Well, not literally, but in many, many places. Verse 12, further, were I to write for him my laws by the 10,000s, they would be regarded as a strange thing. If the whole law were printed thousands of times and it were available to every individual, Hosea seems to say, the Lord says, it would be in vain. They still wouldn't know me. It would be strange. And we talked earlier in our lessons that know is a very powerful word in Hosea. As for my sacrificial offerings, they sacrifice meat and eat it, but the Lord does not accept them. Now he will remember their iniquity and punish their sins. They shall return to another one of those times to Egypt. I think he's saying their sacrifices are nothing more than the eating of flesh. Obviously, eating meat would satisfy hunger. But the point is, as far as service to the Lord, worship to the Lord, it's useless. Their sins wouldn't be forgotten. All of their attempts at Baal worship are useless. Again, I think return to Egypt, return to bondage. For Israel has forgotten his maker and built palaces. Judah comes in again. And Judah has multiplied fortified cities. So they had accomplished great things, built buildings of various kinds that would be remarkable perhaps. But the Lord says, all of that is meaningless. I will send a fire upon his cities, and it shall devour her strongholds. The word stronghold seems to refer to the most secure place at all within a city, the inner city, the citadel, we might call it. But to no avail, but because God would still destroy. Judah, I think we can almost say, while sinful, not as idolatrous as Israel, but enough so that in Hosea's message they are mentioned again. Chapter 9, among other things, I think is a picture of what's coming, although there certainly would be more and more detail later, but in various categories, features of banishment, punishment, particularly in this chapter, loss of happiness. Obviously, if you're taken over by a foreign power, all happiness is gone. I think perhaps in that is the reminder that they would be hundreds and hundreds of miles away. And yes, they would be unhappy, but for many reasons. It's an exile as well, and again, very far away. They would lose spiritual discernment. They've lost that already, but they certainly would not be able to correct that in exile. And notice in particular, they will not be growing in population, declining birth rates. In two or three verses, he emphasizes that. And then in verse 17, it simply is summed up as God's abandonment of Israel. Rejoice not, O Israel. I'm not sure this is so, but many interpreters would say Okay, he actually speaks here to a time when Israel was a little more assured that things were going to work out well. And maybe it was a time when, for instance, the harvest was good and people began to think positively that we're on the right track. Maybe we'll be saved yet. Whether it's that or something else, Hosea is saying, no time to rejoice. It's not as good as it looks. Harvest time, obviously, would be a time of great joy. Isaiah 9:3 reflects that, and we would expect it would always be. It still would be. If we were farmers and it was great harvest, then it would be a happy time for us even today. And then the last phrase, you have loved a prostitute's wages on all threshing floors. During harvest, during the wheat harvest, men would sleep on the threshing floor at night to protect the grain from people who might steal some of it. And I think this reflects the fact that particularly the ritual prostitutes frequented the threshing floors where they knew the men were sleeping. Not the prostitutes, but such a setting that we find in the story of Ruth and Boaz. Threshing floor and wine vat shall not feed them, and a new wine shall fail them. All their trust in Baal would be useless because Baal would not be able to bless. They shall not remain in the land of the Lord, but Ephraim shall return to Egypt. Again, that phrase. And they shall eat unclean food in Assyria. Well, in a foreign land, all of the food would be unclean according to the law of Moses. And again, look forward to that. He would be taken, Ephraim would be taken to a foreign land. They shall not pour out drink offerings of wine to the Lord, and their sacrifices shall not please him. It shall be like mourner's bread to them. All who eat of it shall be defiled. Bread eaten at the time of, for instance, I lose a relative in the law of Moses, then my contact with the dead makes me unclean for a while. Bread eaten at that time, and as I understand it, if you are in the situation of that loss of a relative and I mourn with you and eat bread with you at that time, then I'm eating unclean bread as well. All of their sacrifices are unclean, basically, is the message here. The food would, yes, satisfy their hunger, but that would be all. What will you do on the day of the appointed festival and on the day of the feast of the Lord? I think this is the question. You'll be there one day. What will you do? Well, you have no house of God in which to worship there. You'll have no altar on which to offer burnt offerings. For behold, they are going away from destruction, but Egypt shall gather them, Memphis shall bury them, nettles shall possess their precious things of silver, thorns shall be in their tents. Egypt, again, may be not literally the nation of Egypt, but exile, and specifically in Assyria, but of course Egypt is used as a symbol, and even the ancient capital of Egypt, Memphis. We know the capital of Egypt as Cairo, of course, but in ancient times, Memphis was the capital. I think this pictures what's left behind. Nettles shall possess their precious things of silver. Thorns shall be in their tent. Implied in the going away from destruction, I think, is a picture of what's left behind. If I were taken like that into captivity, I'm sure I would remember home and remember all that was there. But it almost seems like Hosea is saying you can't even think in those terms as well, because all of that is a waste. The precious things are being overgrown by nettles and thorns and so forth. The days of punishment have come, the days of recompense have come. Israel shall know it. There's that word know again. And I think emphasis, of course, here is they will really know, really understand as they suffer in captivity. They'll know the horrors of captivity. And among other things, they will know that Hosea spoke the truth. The prophet is a fool. The man of the spirit is mad because of your great iniquity and great hatred. This may be one of those places where we have kind of a picture, a double picture of things. I think we talked early on about the prophets often doing strange things, but for a purpose. And Hosea's situation was very strange as well to us. And I think across the board, many of the prophets appeared to be fools or crazy to the people to whom they spoke. And looking at it from the other side, then that may have been necessary because the people were so hard-hearted and hard-headed that they had to do the strange, what appeared to be foolish and crazy in order to hopefully get the message across. What will you do in the day of the appointed festival? Looks like I have the same. Verse 8 related again to the images before. The prophet is the watchman of Ephraim with my God, yet a fowler's snare is on all his ways, and hatred in the house of his God. Difficult in a sense, my God and his God. One way of understanding that, I think, is that the true prophet, like Hosea, is indeed, yes, a watchman with God, yet his way is difficult. He's being entrapped by enemies of the Lord and hated in the house of his God. I'm not sure that emphasis is there, but that's one way of understanding my God and his God. But in general, we understand the contrast between the true and that which is not. They have deeply corrupted themselves as in the days of Gibeah. We'll be out of time in a minute. This is another one of those stories that maybe I take too much time with and won't be able to finish it today. But if you don't know this story, in Judges 19, 20, and 21, then let me ask that you go read the story. You know it, but you haven't looked at it in a while. Go back and look at it. I think this is a special point. Hosea is thinking back in their history. What is a time when God's people were as wicked as they are presently? I'll think of that time and I'll talk to them about that and compare it to the present. As in the days of Gibeah, Gibeah is in Benjamin, and there is quite a story there, a story that first of all will remind you of the Sodom story in Genesis. And the end of this section, verse 25 of chapter 21, says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." In our time, we might say it was a Wild West. Every man was his own law with his six gun or whatever. But it was a terrible time. In fact, the whole period of the Judges is much that way. But this one stands out. Let me just start the story. A Levite of Ephraim, how he obtained a concubine from Bethlehem, I'm not sure. She ran away to Bethlehem, home to Bethlehem, and he went to Bethlehem to retrieve her. Her father hindered them from leaving on time, and the Levite left anyway and arrived at a place to spend the night later than they would have. There's only one person in the city that would invite them in. Remember, that's biblical hospitality. You serve the stranger, giving a place to stay and something to eat. He's described as an old man, and he's not even a resident of Gibeah. He's a sojourner there, whether he's there to do his kind of work for a season or whatever it is. He's not really a resident of the place, but he is the one and only, who will invite them in. Well, we'll pick up here next time, and indeed, if this is not a story that's familiar to you, do go look at it, because Hosea is making an important point here. We live in wicked times. You live in wicked times. What can I compare it to? Well, one of the very darkest stories in our history, Gibeah. Okay, thank you.